there's this sort of awful echo of this reintroduction of a corrupt gift-giving culture into the American presidency that is really, really worrying for national security and for trade.
He was sitting there reading this book, and he was disciplined by the university. He used extremely poor judgment by insisting on openly reading the book related to historically and racially abhorrent subject in the presence of your black co-workers.
Hi, and welcome to Amicus, Slate's podcast about the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I cover the courts for Slate. This week, we're going to focus on something it seems that only one person in America knew about before November. That's the Constitution's Emoluments Clause. Luckily, the person who knew about it before November is here to explain to us what it is. Later on in the show, we're going to bring you some highlights of a fascinating discussion about free speech on college campuses that the Jefferson Center for Free Expression held at the University of Virginia earlier this fall. But first, the Emoluments Clause. And joining us to help understand what it is Zephyr Teachout. She's an associate professor at the Fordham School of Law, and she is the author of Corruption in America, a book that actually discusses strange, arcane things like the Emoluments Clause. Zephyr ran for a congressional seat in New York's 19th district in the November election. And last week, she joined a whole bunch of anti-corruption activists to deliver petitions to Trump Tower, asking him to divest or put his assets into a blind trust. So, Zephyr, welcome to Amicus.
Oh, well, I'm thrilled to be on. And I just want to actually clarify something, because there's a lot of terms floating around. Trump has to divest. If he doesn't divest, he's violating the Constitution. So there's a separate, sort of a second step, which is after divesting, it should be put into a blind trust. But if you're asking yourself, you know, if you're walking along saying, is he violating the Constitution or not, the simple question is, has he liquidated his assets? If he hasn't, he's violating the Constitution.
Well, maybe let's just break it down then. I'm going to read Article 1, Section 9, Clause 8. Of the Constitution so that our listeners know what we're talking about. It says that no American office holder shall, quote, without the consent of the Congress, accept of any present emolument, office, or title of any kind, whatever, from any king, prince, or foreign state, end quote. Zephyr, what is the Constitution driving at with that language, and what is an emolument?
Well, there's different elements of it, and there's one part prohibits taking gifts, and the other part prohibits taking emoluments or payments. It's basically a payment. So the simple idea is you don't want your, you know, Secretary of State on the payroll of the French government. That would be bad. the emoluments prohibits taking payments. So the imagined situation at the time of the clause was elaborate gifts, you know, gifts worth a lot of money, which would then fit under the presence part of the clause, or some kind of stipend from a foreign government. And one of the things, I mean, you read the clause, one of the things to notice about it is how insistent and petulant it is. It's like the First Amendment. You know, it has this language of any kind whatever. And I argue in my book that it actually represents this really fundamental American spirit that we have to fight against foreign corruption, and that foreign corruption is actually one of the core downfalls of past republics. And that's what the founders saw, is that foreign governments would spare no expense, as they talked about at the Constitutional Convention, spare no expense to try to influence trade policy in war and peace, which makes perfect sense. Right before the American Revolution, there's a, you know the phrase jackboot?
Sure.
Ever heard that?
Sure.
Yeah. So the phrase jackboot comes from Lord Bute, who had been a prime minister and then was a close advisor to George III. You know, I don't know what really happened. I just know the rumors from several hundred years ago. But the rumor is he took a lot of money from the French government and encouraged George III to make peace while others in England were fighting the opposite, basically taking cash in exchange for making foreign policy. And that's, you know, that's what the founders were worried about, and that's what we should be worried about right now, because Trump has effectively announced, he announced that he's not announcing, but, you know, in Trump world, that means he has told us that as of right now, when he becomes president, he will be taking payments from foreign interests and he will be indebted to the Chinese government. I mean, that's an outrageous position for an American president, let alone any American office holder to be in who has power over war and peace and trade.
So help us understand, Zephyr, what the line is between taking payments, accepting monies. I mean, from what I understand, the clause is violated if he gets anything that is at above market value. Is that the line that he's got to not cross here?
You know, we're not even close to the line. Because of Trump's business empire, he's regularly getting payments from foreign governments. And both Richard Painter, the ethics lawyer for George Bush, and Norm Eisen, the ethics lawyer for President Obama, have agreed on this, that the taking of payments from foreign government-owned companies itself violates the Emoluments Clause. Then there's the separate question about whether you're taking a present, which is something that's a greater value. So he needs to divest. I think that, you know, This sounds complicated and arcane, but this is actually really common sense. You don't want a federal office holder, particularly the president, being in a position where, let's say the Bank of China, which he is currently indebted to, can change the terms in order to impact foreign policy decisions regarding our military relationship with China or our trade relationship with China. And one of the things we know about Donald Trump is that he doesn't like to be a loser, doesn't like to be perceived as a loser. And that creates an incredible vulnerability. Imagine his businesses aren't doing well, the tabloids are making fun of his children for running his businesses into the ground. That creates an incredible vulnerability and opportunity for foreign governments to say, hey, you know, we can change the terms of a repayment of a debt, affect how his businesses are doing, and in exchange, get a different trade deal, make the Trump administration quieter on prosecuting anti-dumping laws or you know trade violations with China. I mean, I've mentioned China a lot. Obviously, one of the big concerns we have now is Russia and the relationship with Russia. And there's this sort of awful echo of history where one of the things that motivated the Emoluments Clause was Benjamin Franklin got a glamorous, decorated snuff box from the King of France. And as Edmund Randolph said in the Virginia Ratifying Conventions, we were really worried that if we didn't have a clause that required Congress to approve this kind of gift, people would say, hey, Franklin's been corrupted by the King of France. And they would even look at the friendly relationship of France with some suspicion. And that would actually undermine the American ability to deal in a friendly way with France throughout the war. Well, just a few years ago, and you may have seen this reported, Putin gave a lacquered box to Donald Trump. Obviously, that wasn't a violation of the Emoluments Clause. He wasn't a president at the time. But there's this sort of awful echo of this reintroduction of a corrupt gift-giving culture into the American presidency that is really, really worrying and really worrying for national security and really worrying for trade.
And Zephyr, it sounds like you're saying that this has something in common with the other corruption you've written about so much, which is it's not just about the gifting. It's about the appearance that somebody is vulnerable to the gifting, right? I mean, this is not just about the gift itself. It's about making sure that the whole sort of enterprise of governance isn't tainted by what looks to be, you know, bribes or blackmail or other transactions.
Right. So just, you know, again, it's not going to take too long before there's a, you know, quote-unquote coincidence where there is a business transaction that comes within several months of a trade transaction. And that will call into question the integrity of our trade policy, call into question the integrity of our decisions in military affairs. That itself is troubling, as is the actual corruption that's in this case. And the appearance has sort of two problems. One is how the appearance affects those of us here in the United States. But the other troubling thing is that now that Trump is setting it up, he's sort of setting up a machine designed to attract corrupting forces around the world. Now, we've seen really bad experiences with other businessmen in executive positions around the world, whether you look at Berlusconi or Thaksin in Thailand, businessmen in government who have enriched themselves have done very poorly by their countries. But what's unique about the United States is that our trade policy and our military policy has such a global impact that basically Trump is setting up a honeypot. The Trump businesses, and it's already happening, are going to be attracting states from around the world trying to influence. They may not always be successful, but trying to influence trade and military policy by accessing the Trump empire. And that's really troubling. So it's a very destabilizing situation. But there's an important other part of the clause, which I think people haven't paid enough attention to, which is that it is not just a clause that gives the president responsibility. It's a clause that gives Congress responsibility. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, you know, when you're approving, for instance, a Supreme Court justice, the Senate has a constitutional role. Well, when it comes to emoluments, Congress has a constitutional role. So if you go back to the section that you read, you said, without the consent of Congress, mm-hmm. the office holder can't accept these emoluments, right?
Right.
What that means is that Congress has to consent. And what that means is our pressure here shouldn't just be on Trump, but on every Congress member to say, hey, you have an obligation. You as a Congress member are violating the Constitution right now if you are not actively monitoring the Trump payments and gifts. And to be clear, you know, violation of the Emoluments Clause was used as an example of grounds for impeachment at the time of the Constitutional Convention. So in the Virginia Ratifying Convention, Edmund Randolph, describing impeachment processes, used violation of emoluments as a reason for impeachment. So this puts a really active responsibility on members of Congress. And I don't want to see members of Congress getting away with saying, well, that's Trump's decision, you know, he's following his own lawyers. No, by not actively monitoring, investigating, either approving or disapproving payments or gifts, members of Congress are violating their own constitutional and patriotic duty.
Zephyr, what's wrong with the fix that Trump has suggested after saying, OK, I'm going to have a press conference and announce a big fix? He scuttled that. But he has said, listen, my kids are going to run the company and there's no deals. We'll have just no deals for the next 4 years. I'm guessing that doesn't satisfy your reading of the Emoluments Clause.
Well, first of all, it just doesn't make any sense. I mean, I don't know what no deals means. It's sort of like we're back to debating what is, because a business that isn't making deals isn't a business. You know, you stop, you know, simple terms of repayment of debt. There's constant negotiation. So it just is actually an incoherent sentence to say there's no new deals. So I mentioned earlier both Berlusconi and Thaksin in Thailand. This is, you know, old school corruption 101 is to say, oh, it's my kids who are doing it, not me. That's what Thaksin did. That's what Berlusconi did. So I don't think that he's actually been clear at all about what's going to happen, except for one thing. He's keeping an ownership interest. And as long as he's keeping an ownership interest, we have a problem.
Zephyr, the last question I want to ask you has to do with what looks like at least some internecine and arcane fighting between con law professors about whether this clause even applies to the president, right? I mean, there has certainly been argument offered that the president is not subject to these constraints.
Yep. The argument has to do with the language used in the clause and whether it applies to the president and to elected officials.
Mm-hmm.
But there is both contemporary evidence from the Constitutional Convention and subsequent evidence that presidents and elected officials assumed it applied to them. And you're welcome to go to Northwestern Online debate between myself and Seth Barrett Tillman. We were debating this question 3 years ago. It seemed at the time not to be, you know, I do want to say one thing. Sometimes things seem arcane because they're so unimportant that they're, you know, fighting over how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. But the reason this hasn't been litigated isn't because it's so unimportant. It's because it's so important. The reason this hasn't been litigated is because no president has even thought to come close to violating this foreign bribery provision. So it's not because it's irrelevant. It's because it's so fundamental, what President Van Buren called a fundamental law of the republic, that the idea of even coming close to violating it hasn't come up. So some of the questions you're asking about, where are the lines, haven't come up, not because it's trivial, but because it's so basic that any self-respecting president has stayed miles away from the lines and it hasn't been litigated.
So they do that by just divesting, right? That's what...
By liquidating, and yes. But I want to give some examples from the 19th century just to give you a sense of how seriously this has been taken. So President Martin Van Buren was offered horses, pearls, shawls, and a sword by the Imam of Muscat in 1840. You'd think the nice thing to do when you're offered pearls and a sword is just say, thank you.
That's what I do.
Right. But instead, he wrote a letter saying that he was forbidden from taking the presents for his own use. And he needed to check with Congress first. So he got a joint resolution of Congress authorizing him to get rid of the presents by and then give the proceeds to the Department of State and to Treasury. I mean, Van Buren took this as a fundamental, again, I used the language before, and he used this language, a fundamental law of our republic, that we don't just take money from foreign powers. Or President Tyler was given just two horses, and he submitted them to Congress, which then gave him the authority to sell them and give the money to Treasury.
And Zephyr, you used the word impeachment. That's the only cure here, right? I mean, if the president doesn't divest, there isn't some other fix. Congress either approves the gifts or impeaches?
Well, that's the first fix, or that's Congress's obligation. I will tell you that I and others are also looking at other ways to address this. As you know very well, the answer in a legal question is uncertain until we go to the courts.
Right.
So, you know, here we have both a congressional obligation and a presidential obligation, a clause that hasn't been tested. I wouldn't say that we know right now that the only answer is impeachment and the only answer is congressional engagement. I think that we as lawyers and citizens have an obligation, because this is such a fundamental violation, to look at other legal remedies as well.
Zephyr Teachout is an associate professor at the Fordham School of Law. She's the author of Corruption in America, which it turns out involves a lot more than snuff boxes and shawls and pearls. Last week, Zephyr joined other anti-corruption activists to deliver 200,000 petitions to Trump Tower, demanding that Trump sell his assets and put them into a blind trust. Zephyr, thank you so very much for joining us today on Amicus.
Great to be on. Thanks a lot.
It's a new year, but it's the same old, no law, just vibe Supreme Court. I'm Melissa Murray.
I'm Leah Littman.
I'm Kate Shaw. And we are the hosts of the Strict Scrutiny podcast on Crooked Media, who also happen to be constitutional law professors in our free time.
Join us each week as we unpack what's on the docket for the Supreme Court term and break down the latest headlines while still managing a laugh or two.
So whether you're a lawyer, a law student, or just trying to make sense of what these cases mean,
Strict Scrutiny has got you covered.
New episodes out every Monday, wherever you get your podcasts.
It's time for some bad decisions.
Is the right to free speech under threat on the nation's college and university campuses? That was the question at the heart of a two-day symposium at the University of Virginia this past October. It was organized by the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression in Charlottesville, home base of this very podcast. I'm on the board of the Jefferson Center, and I was fortunate enough to be invited to be a panelist in the October symposium. For the remainder of this show, we're going to share a few highlights from this truly thought-provoking event. It was motivated by the drip, drip of controversies over the past few years about a whole range of speech restrictions on campuses, things like trigger warnings and speech codes and the sanctioning of invited speakers and faculty members and student newspapers in response to unwelcome ideas that they had articulated. The Jefferson Center Symposium tried to better understand the legal issues raised by these controversies and what colleges and universities can do going forward to stay on solid constitutional ground. The first piece of audio we're going to play is from the leadoff panel. It's a little bit on the long side, so bear with us. You're going to recognize the voice because, well, it's mine.
So just in the interest of setting the table, and I think some of these points have been made already, but, Greg Lukianoff, president and chief executive of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, almost a year ago this month, put forward in a big, big piece, a cover story for The Atlantic, the proposition that this all represents, quote, the coddling of the American mind. And he went on to list a whole host of things, some of which you've heard, comedians who stop coming to campus because they don't want to be shouted down anymore, a professor at Yale who's advised that she cannot teach rape law using rape language because it's triggering, Laura Kipnis at Northwestern, who's subject to a Title IX complaint about an article that she wrote. You know, this is a huge panoply of actions that happen on campus in addition to what we're hearing about at Yale, at Missouri, the complete collapse of civil discourse in gotcha snippets of video that then go viral as though to implicate an entire group of protesters on either side, and maybe more troubling, really, really deep cuts at, for instance, the Wesleyan student newspaper based on an article that was printed that could have been printed in any, right-wing columnist newspaper, but actual funding being cut and actual funding at student professors. And this really, I think, escalates when you have, again, at Missouri, protesters chasing out reporters and saying this can't be covered, having to sign a pledge as a reporter that you will cover a topic that you agree with, but if you don't agree with it, you can be bounced out of the room. And the real implications, I think, for student press that have to be a central part of this conversation. And all this culminates, as John Jeffrey suggests, in the letter that goes out to University of Chicago freshmen saying, welcome to school, we sure hope you don't have feelings. This scene as a really, savvy and sophisticated response to a panoply of the problems I've just listed. And so what I want to suggest is that for one thing, and this is important from that Atlantic article last year that I think at least triggered this wave of discourse in the media around the subject, this is not the same as the wave of, quote, political correctness and speech code we saw on campus, when I was coming up not that long ago. This is a very different proposition, a huge part of it informed by new media, by the ability to create a record on a camera. So this is not same old, same old. This is, I think, an escalation, both in kind and really in meaning, in existential meaning of what we've been seeing for the last decades. So what are the claims of the folks that are seeking trigger warnings, a stop to what they call microaggressions and safe spaces? They're not in any way unreasonable claims. What they're saying is this isn't just speech, that this is speech that leads to hateful acts, and that sometimes it itself is experienced as an assault. And that this is not, to say this is just speech is to not understand the effect that speech can have on you as a student isolated in a college away from home, possibly from the first time. Their claim is that the campus is a special place. And I think this is another point that Blake makes so artfully. This is not the real world. This is a place that's supposed to be fomenting something that is not quite the real world, and that it has an obligation to protect you from the most brutal components of real world discourse. And I think most profoundly their claim is, again, it doesn't sound wrong to me, that this isn't necessarily about free speech, but license for privileged groups to offend and marginalize and put down groups that have historically been offended and marginalized before. And so this is not a playing field that is necessarily equal. This is a playing field that benefits groups that have always been benefit, and they want to level the playing field. So that's the arguments on the one side. And of course, the claims on the other are pretty self-evident. And here I would just quote David Baugh, who is the African-American lawyer who initially represented Barry Black in the cross-burning case at the Supreme Court. And when he asked about the campus speech problem, he said, look, part of being an American is the obligation to listen to language that makes you uncomfortable. And braided into that response, I would say I did a panel a few months ago and listened to Ted Shaw from the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, who's as conflicted as I am about these issues. And his point was that as soon as you start restricting speech, ostensibly to protect disadvantaged groups, you know who always gets it in the end? The disadvantaged groups. That it is invariably, in his view, the African American who is hurt more by speech codes and attempts to protect minorities than anyone else. And that's the slippery slope that he fears. So the arguments on this side, of course, are the self-evident First Amendment arguments, that the cure for bad speech is more speech, and the way to air bad ideas is to discuss them and not to suppress them, and that college exists to teach critical thinking and to shape minds. And if you protect people from any idea that they find offensive, you are not doing the foundational work that colleges are meant to be doing. And I think the coda to all that is that coddled children who are protected from any bad words that they don't want to hear cannot then go out into the world and function the way Blake is suggesting we need to function out in the world, that college is not the place to remove real meaningful discourse in the interest of pure civility. So those are the arguments. I want to just tell you what students want, and I think, again, John Jeffries hinted at this, but this is the part that's quite dispiriting. I don't know if you've seen the Gallup poll from 2016 that shows that regardless of the academic abstract argument that we may have in this room, students really, really like the idea of suppressing speech. And 69% of students polled in this recent Gallup poll say that they think that there should be speech codes that restrict slurs or offensive language. 69% approve of such speech codes. 63% want schools to restrict any costumes that stereotype racial or ethnic groups. 49% support restricting the media's right to cover protests. Let me say that again. 49% of students polled favor some restrictions on the media's right to cover a protest. 55% of students believe that campus climates, quote, prevent people from saying things that they would like to say. So there is an enormous, I think, conflict right there, where we have students who want more restriction of speech, but also feel that they are not themselves free to speak. And it seems to me that that is the paradox at the heart of this conversation around speech, that everyone wants more free speech for themselves and wants to be able to say exactly what they want to say on campus, but they want to hear less and less speech that offends them. So I want to just make this point because I think it's so crucial to the conversation that will happen in the next 2 days. It is so critically important for purposes of this conversation to disaggregate all of the different pieces of what we call speech suppressive regulation on campus. And that means that disinviting speakers from campuses is one problem. It is a separate problem from shouting down speakers at protests, which is a separate problem from defunding newspapers or regulating what newspapers can publish, which is a separate problem from disciplining fraternities or student groups for costumes they may wear or events they may hold, which is in itself a different problem for demands inside the classroom for trigger warnings or safe spaces to discuss complicated and fraught issues, which in itself is a different problem from campus speech codes, which include the 10 UC campuses this year that have enacted regulations suggesting that discussing criticism of Israel can be construed as anti-Semitism. That in itself is a different problem from the discipline of academics for things they may post online. These are not the same problem. They do not carry with them the same First Amendment interests, and they do not carry with them the same pedagogical interests. And so going forward, it seems to me, unless we can be very crisp in defining what we are talking about when we talk about campus speech and the blowback to campus speech, this is an almost impossible conversation to have. Also, I would just say that it is not in any way useful for us to be talking about this in terms of calling student special snowflakes on the one hand and deriding their interests, or alternatively, in really saying that institutions have a deeply entrenched interest in punching down to disadvantaged minorities. None of those stereotypes are true, so I think we have to have a much more open-hearted understanding of what the interests on the other side are.
So that was me speaking at a Charlottesville symposium back in October called Free Speech on Campus. The next speaker you're going to hear is Eugene Volokh. He's also on the board of the Thomas Jefferson Center for Free Expression. He's a law professor at UCLA, and he's founder of the incredibly indispensable libertarian slash conservative legal blog, Volokh Conspiracy. In the clip you're about to hear, Eugene has just recounted the story of a moot court at an unnamed law school where students were apparently reprimanded by a faculty advisor for mentioning a very relevant legal precedent, simply because that precedent had to do with the potentially hurtful subject of cross-burning. So here's Eugene.
So here's one perspective for thinking about it. Imagine that you'd heard 5 years ago Rush Limbaugh say, you know what's wrong with all of this talk about trigger warnings and safe spaces and speech codes and such? I can imagine that what's going to happen is somebody won't be able to have a moot court where it has a leading precedent because that happens to be about cross-burning. Everybody would have said, oh, that's ridiculous, conservative scaremongering. You're just building up this nonsensical straw man to ride in your foolish parade of horribles. That's what they'd say. If there was a term that I could come up for the last 5 years, it would be kind of the march of the living straw man. That the straw men who we thought were straw men have come to life. They're not actually straw men at all. They really are there. They really are there. So this fellow is Lord Melbourne. He's noteworthy for various things. He was a prime minister, not of no great accomplishments, I think. In England. The city of Melbourne in Australia is named after him. He became notorious because his wife had a very public affair with Lord Byron, the poet. In fact, apparently she was the one who coined the famous phrase about Byron was mad, bad, and dangerous to know. And the other thing about Melbourne is that apparently the king who appointed him as prime minister in 1832 described him as, quote, the least bad choice, close quote. So he's a colorful fellow, but I'm going to appropriate him for one purpose and one purpose only. There's this quote that's been making the rounds, that it's so useful for so many things. It's attributed to him. So there's some doubt about provenance, but good enough for our purposes. What all the wise men promised has not happened, and what all the damn fools said would happen has come to pass. When there's talk about these speech codes, like the speech code that was struck down in Dilley University of Michigan or various others, it's always, well, look, just very modest restrictions, just civility. Who's against civility? Let's just make sure that people talk in productive, thoughtful ways. Let's ban epithets, or at least certain kinds of epithets. And when somebody says, well, what about the implications? Oh, slippery slope. That's just slippery slope nonsense. Somehow it all comes to pass, sometimes in that very code that's being proposed, in the very examples to it. Let me give an example. So let's say there's a university and people decide they want to have a protest by trampling on the Confederate flag. And offended students file charges of attempts to incite violence and create a hostile environment, charges of actions of incivility. And university begins month-long investigation of the college Democrats who organized that. Oh, I'm just joking. Obviously, that would never happen. It's obviously clear that trampling on a flag is constitutionally protected symbolic expression, and people are free to do that, even if some people are quite offended. Well, this is what did happen. There was an incident in which the College Republicans at San Francisco State University were trampling on the Hamas flag. Now, I used the Confederate flag analogy advisedly. This is from the Hamas charter. The day of judgment will not come about until Muslims fight Jews and kill them. That's just a little sample of what the Hamas Charter says. This is Hamas Charter, quoting a passage from the Quran. So the SFSU people didn't like much Hamas, so they made a copy of the Hamas flag and they trampled on it. Now, it turns out the Hamas flag, in the Arabic calligraphy, contains the name of Allah. They didn't know that, although perhaps if they did know that, they'd say, okay, fine, well, all right. But we're Trump. We don't like Hamas. Offended students filed charges of attempts to incite violence and create a hostile environment and actions of incivility. University began months-long investigation of college Republicans. Again, if you made that up as a hypo at the time the speech code that ultimately was struck down by federal district court on First Amendment grounds, when it was proposed, people said, well, no, obviously not. No, we were just after people going around shouting epithets. Well, oddly enough, that wasn't what it was limited to. And of course, you could tell by reading it, because if you read the speech codes, you will often find that when the way they're interpreted is actually quite consistent with the way that they were written. Janitors reading a book leads to discipline by university. What's the book? Notre Dame versus the Klan. He was sitting there reading it at, I want to get this right, Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. Am I right? It's UPUI, or I don't know how it's pronounced. He was sitting there reading this book, public university, and he was disciplined by the university. You used extremely poor judgment by insisting on openly reading the book related to historically and racially abhorrent subject in the presence of your black coworkers. That he was creating this bad environment for black coworkers for reading a book that was about the Klan. Now, this is not The Birth of a Nation. This is a book about how the Fighting Irish defeated the Ku Klux Klan. Not good enough. You shouldn't have read the book about any such topic at the university. Again, if somebody had come up with this as a hypo, people would have mocked him for setting up a straw man.
That's Eugene Volokh, a First Amendment specialist at the UCLA School of Law. Now, another First Amendment specialist who spoke as part of the symposium in October was Leslie Kendrick. She's on the faculty here at the University of Virginia School of Law. And as you'll hear in the next excerpt, Leslie offered an extremely helpful framework for grounding this often nebulous concept of, quote, academic freedom.
It's important to sort out, I think, when we're out having these discussions, are we making a descriptive point, this is what the law is, or a normative point? So someone says, he shouldn't have been fired for saying that. Does that mean it was illegal to fire him for saying that, or it should be illegal to fire him for saying that? It's often not very clear. So if we're talking purely about the normative perspective, we don't care what the law is in this country, but we want to say this is how the law should be, I think it's important to recognize that people have different perspectives on this, both in terms of the all-purpose rules that should govern and the university-specific rules. So for a lot of people who want to argue for more regulation of speech on college campuses, I'm always curious about, do they mean that should be the rule that governs all of us as citizens, that hate speech should be a category of unprotected speech? Or do they mean the university is special in some way, and we have to have special speech regulation that pertains only to the university? It's important to ask that question, because those are two very different types of arguments to be making. And you could make an argument that we should have more regulation of hate speech as a normative matter across the board in our society. A lot of the European Union does a lot more of it. Basically, all Western democracies do more of that type of regulation than we do. So you could have a normative conversation about that. You could also have normative conversations about the university and what the university is supposed to look like. And people, I think, come at this from two different directions. Some people say, of all places, the university is the one that should be the most preserving of free speech. A university is a place of free inquiry, free debate. That's what a university's for. That's what it does. But you could also have people who say, regardless of what we do with hate speech out there in the world, when you have students who are paying to be part of a community, and they've recently, you know, we're usually talking about young people here, they're just starting out, they have equal standing in that community with other people, and they have a right to expect that their basic right to be there, their basic status as an individual deserving of equal dignity and respect will not be undermined by the very institution that they've gone to get an education. So those are two different views that put special duties on universities, either special duty to recognize freedom of speech or special duty to regulate it.
That was UVA professor Leslie Kendrick.
Now, further complicating this picture that she lays out is the fact that the bounds of academic freedom may depend at least in part on whether or not a professor is employed by a public or a private university. And this was one of the ideas offered up at the same symposium by Vikram Amar, dean at the University of Illinois College of Law. Let's listen to him talk about that for a few minutes.
It's often thought that as professors, especially at public universities, we enjoy some special role to play in the First Amendment and that we're protected by some special academic freedom. I'm not actually sure that we public faculty have it so good in this respect. And to illustrate that, I want to compare the free speech rights of public faculty to three other groups: students, private faculty, and other public employees. I think it's pretty clear to me that students have more expressive rights than faculty do at public universities. I think, you know, if going back to the microaggression policy at the UC, UC defined microaggressions to include things like saying America is a melting pot, or that the best person should get the job. And if a university tried to punish students or deter students from saying those kinds of things, I think everyone would say, of course they have a First Amendment right to that. But to the extent that they're trying to direct faculty activities, there's more leeway for the employer to do that. And the reason is because they are our employer. And competing with the First Amendment's right to speak is the right of employers to accomplish their employment goals. There's a long line of cases, Connick, Myers, Garcetti, that say that employers can regulate speech of employees even when the employers are public, with a pretty generous hand. Now, there's some question about whether Garcetti fully applies to public faculty. There's a bracket in the case that refers to this idea of academic freedom. But in my experience, every time the Supreme Court has gone back to look at academic freedom as a constitutional matter, it doesn't usually find too much. The second comparison is between public and private faculty. Here, too, I think, you know, if you look at what the government could do to regulate faculty down the road at Duke, it's far less than what they could do to regulate faculty here at the university. If the legislature of Virginia wants to tell the faculty at UVA what to do, they have a much greater leeway to do so than at a private school. So relative to our private counterparts, we actually have less, even though we work for the government. And then third, and this one is the most counterintuitive, I think faculty have fewer expressive rights at public universities than non-faculty employees in a lot of ways. You say, well, we're all employees, so shouldn't we at least be on a par with people who work in other elements of the university? And I'm not sure, for two reasons. One is, there is inherently a content and viewpoint-based appraisal of people who do scholarly work. It's impossible to assess scholarship without assessing the viewpoint and the subject matter of what's being done. Some scholarship is not valuable because it doesn't talk about important things. And some scholarship is not valuable because it takes positions that are not credible given scholarly norms. And so there's the faculty are already in an arena where their bosses are having to make these determinations. If I as a I didn't think that the challenge to Obamacare under the Constitution in 2012, I didn't think it was a very strong constitutional argument. And I didn't do this, but if I as a dean were to decide not to extend an offer of employment to someone because their article laying out the argument wasn't very good scholarship to me because I didn't think the argument made sense, I'm not sure she has a First Amendment claim. So the fact that we are in the idea business opens us up to evaluation based on the content and sometimes the viewpoint of our ideas. That's not true for people who work for the university who are not engaged in the ideas. Secondly, and relatedly, what we do as professors is sometimes affected by our off-the-job activities. If a professor is a member of the KKK, she may not be able to do her job in the classroom in a way that a groundskeeper could be a member of the KKK and still mow a mean lawn. And the reality is we have to engage our students. They have to find us credible. They have to find us accessible. They can't be afraid of us. They can't be turned off by us. And that, too, gives the government employer more leeway to regulate us. So I think in a lot of ways academic freedom is an idea that we talk about, but I'm not sure how much constitutional content there is to it. I will say three things before I stop. One is the Constitution is not the only game in town. A lot of times academics are protected by custom, by tradition, by contract law, by regulation, by promises. So great universities promise to allow more leeway than the Constitution might require. And so whenever we're in a university context, we always have to be clear, and this goes back again to something I think Leslie said, we've got to be clear, you know, what body of law we're looking at, what's doing the constraint. Sometimes it's not the Constitution, but it's a norm or a promise that's been made that's equally constraining. Second, within the Constitution, due process is an under-discussed value with respect to academic freedom. I tend to think of academic freedom not so much as a right to say what I want to say, but a right to know what's going to get me into trouble. And so I think that the university employers have to give clear guidance about what crosses lines, and you just don't want academics to be sandbagged. I think that's bad business, and at some point it violates the Constitution. And then finally, I think academic freedom or free speech among academics used to be very important in a different sense of the word free. And by this I mean the speech used to be very subsidized. We tend to think of freedom as freedom from government regulation, but if government is going to pay for your speech, that's another sense, an important sense in which it's free. Public university faculty get to speak freely because someone else is footing the bill. And that's a very important element of freedom, but it's one that unfortunately is becoming less meaningful in a world where states have defunded public universities. And I think that people don't pay as much attention, but that is in some ways the bigger threat to research ambition and the proliferation of ideas that's out there, is just that we're not providing the platform to do it as opposed to regulations that are telling us what we can't do.
That was Vikram Amar, Dean at the University of Illinois College of Law, which raises the question, what is it really about free speech that we hold so very dear, and why do we value it, especially in the academic context? Dartmouth College professor of philosophy Susan Bryson had some incredibly interesting things to say on this front. Let's listen to her here talking about what she refers to as the, quote, argument from truth, end quote. This is the idea that the free exchange of ideas gets us closer and closer to the truth, because when it's pitted against falsehood, truth will always win out. Here's Susan Bryson.
I think the argument from truth, that is, that we don't want the government to be restricting speech, because if they do so, the truth is less likely to win out in the long run, is actually a pretty good argument for allowing free speech of a certain kind in a philosophy seminar where people are actually there because they're trying to arrive at the truth about some subject or other, right? And they're all sort of rational processors of information, listening ideally to each other, and have this common goal of arriving at the truth. Right. But if you look at the world today and how people communicate with other people, look at major media outlets, it doesn't seem like what we're talking about is a philosophy seminar. Okay, so another argument is the argument from democracy, that we can't have the government restricting speech because that's going to interfere with our having a well-functioning democracy. Everybody needs to be able to express their views, and everybody needs to have access to everybody else's opinions. But sometimes speech can silence other people. Right? If people are being marginalized and excluded from the conversation, if they're being threatened or humiliated so that they don't feel that they can speak, we're not going to be hearing their views. But what I find interesting about these two arguments for free speech is they both are based on the view that we value speech because of what it can do for us, right? Why do we value speech? We value it for its ability to lead us to the truth ultimately, or for its ability to bring about a well-functioning democracy. But if that's your view, if you give that kind of consequentialist argument for a right to free speech, then you need to be open to the possibility that restrictions on speech might be better able to serve that goal. That's going to be an empirical question. So some philosophers have instead said, no, look, the right to free speech just is a fundamental human right. It's part of the right to autonomy that we all have. This is a purported to be a non-consequentialist argument for the right to free speech, that for the government to stop me from saying something, it's just violating my right to autonomy, even if stopping me is going to bring about, the greatest happiness for the greatest number, is going to bring about a better society. Right? The difficulty with this, there are several difficulties. One is that it's very difficult to pin anyone down on what is meant by autonomy. A number of legal theorists cite Harry Frankfurt's view about autonomy, that's a matter of having your first-order desires in line with your higher-order preferences. But if you look at that philosophical view, you could actually be autonomous, an autonomous individual, and be bound, gagged, and thrown into a dungeon by your government. So it doesn't really work to support this particular view about free speech. But in addition, people who propose this need to acknowledge, I think, the ways in which people using speech can undermine other people's right to autonomy. If you buy this, that we do have a right to autonomy, then I think there is an obligation to say, to determine whether unrestricted speech can sometimes violate that right as much as restrictions on speech. So I realize I haven't been able to argue for this in any depth at all, but my claim is that these defenses of the right to free speech don't actually show us why speech that has certain harmful effects can't justifiably be restricted.
That was Susan Bryson, professor of philosophy at Dartmouth College. The very last snippet we're going to share with you today is from historian Claudrina Harold. She's a professor at the University of Virginia, and she focuses on the 20th century American South. In the section you're going to hear, she reflects on an earlier generation of UVA students who took a stand for a university community that was more inclusive of African Americans and of women, and at the time it was a very unpopular stand. Here's Claudrina Harold.
I truly believe that those folks who were organizing in 1964 and 1965, what it meant to sit in Cabell Hall in 1963 when Dr. King says segregation is on its deathbed, and what it meant to clap in that audience, took courage. They were not the majority. And I truly believe that the stance that they took on issues of race, on issues of gender equity, they helped create the modern UVA as I know it. And that couldn't have happened without free speech. That couldn't have happened without the ability to speak and to critique. My understanding of free speech is very much informed by an anti-lynching activist by the name of Ida B. Wells. Ida B. Wells actually had a newspaper in Memphis called Free Speech. And Ida B. Wells was one of the most outspoken critics of lynching. In 1892, she had three of her best friends were murdered. And she wrote a piece condemning their lynching, but also condemning the ideas that undergirded lynching. There was a $10,000 bounty placed on her. She has to flee Memphis, and she never comes back. Free speech, it carries a cost. But I strongly believe, and I don't care what's your political position, I strongly believe it's critical to a robust democracy. It's critical to our students knowing more. I don't want in my class on living wage for all of the students to agree, because I know they don't. And nothing concerns me more as a teacher when I'm in a class and I know someone has a different perspective and they don't speak out. Because that person who believes that wages are based on the market, I need them to say that, because I also need that student in my class who believes otherwise to know that they need to read that work on economics. So part of me and part of my efforts to be an effective teacher is addressing all of these issues and saying the classroom has to be a place of robust intellectual activity. It's all I got. The responsibility of teaching, the vocation of the scholar, the vocation of the Black scholar, my understanding of it as it relates to someone like Du Bois, this is not a game for me. It's not about me. It's not about my ego. It's about advancing knowledge.
Those were just a few of the highlights from Free Speech on Campus, a symposium staged earlier this fall by the Thomas Jefferson Center for Free Expression at the University of Virginia. You can watch video of the entire two-day event on their webpage. We'll link to it from our own show page, slate.com/amicus. And that is going to do it for this year-ending edition of Amicus. You can email us your thoughts about anything in today's show or anything you'd like to hear in a future show. Our address is amicus@slate.com. And you can also leave a comment on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/amicuspodcast. A quick note to those of you who may still be looking for that perfect something for a friend or family member in your life. Slate Plus, our premium membership program, makes a terrific holiday gift for other Slate fans in your life. Members will get access to transcripts of each of our episodes, as well as ad-free podcasts, bonus podcast segments, and access to our Slate Academies. Give Slate Plus today at slate.com/giveplus. It's a terrific way to support Slate's independent journalism now more than ever. A great big thanks goes out, as always, to the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, where we tape our show. A special thanks also goes out today to the good folks at the Thomas Jefferson Center for Free Expression for sharing their conference audio with us. Tony Field is the producer of Amicus. Steve Lichtai is our executive producer. The chief content officer of Panoply is Andy Bowers. Amicus is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. Happy holidays and a happy new year to you and yours. And we'll be back with you soon in the new year with another edition of Amicus.